I am not sure if this is true or not, but what danger is pareidolia causing in the United States?
What danger?
Mm-hmm.
Specifically now versus another time?
For quite a while now, because of pareidolia, everybody's home is a little bit more dangerous.
Hmm.
And you should know this because you have a young child.
Pareidolia is the phenomenon where you see patterns where they don't actually exist. So looking at clouds and you see a dog in them or a cat in them or a dragon.
I thought it was mostly about faces. Is it about any pattern?
It's any pattern, but it's commonly faces.
Okay, yeah. This one is the common form.
Okay. See, so you're seeing faces in your home, mm-hmm. and it's making you less safe.
Yes, kind of. Actually, oppositely. The desire to see the face has caused the home to be more dangerous.
I mean, probably there are more people making toast because they want to see the Virgin Mary in the toast.
Oh, that's good. No, this is widespread in almost every new home now in the United States. Is made more dangerous because of pareidolia.
Outlets look like surprise faces?
Yes. It is Edison outlets with a ground plug.
This turned upside down?
They are upside down. The ground plug should be up. If the ground plug is up and something metal falls on it, it'll hit the ground. And even if it hits the live line on the left or right mm-hmm. or the neutral line, it'll short out to ground, thereby tripping a breaker or potentially not causing any damage.
Interesting.
But people liked the look of the face. And so people started installing them with the ground pinned down. And that is more dangerous.
Mm.
Neat, huh?
Okay. That's pretty cool.
Or that's completely fictitious. I just heard it and I thought it was neat.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it does seem like a thing. Like, you are less safe because of it.
Yeah.
And probably people do install it that way because they like the face. I mean, I like the face. I like the
all
wow
of a sudden
face.
Don't like the face. But it's interesting. I was just doing some wiring and I put the ground plug down because if you put it up, it feels wrong and different.
It does.
Yeah.
Yeah. It feels like it's backwards.
You know how Great Britain does plugs?
Yeah, they're big, fat blocks. So,
they are.
Yeah.
So in Great Britain, there's two pins, and of course, the voltage there is standardly 240 or 220. Those little round pins that are the actual pins are shorter, both of them are live, effectively, mm-hmm. and the longer pin is the ground pin. But the short pins have an insulator the first maybe 2 centimeters.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And therefore,
for that reason.
If they're unplugged enough so you can put your finger in or a fork in or something, they're not connected to the mains.
Yeah.
So you can't do the problem you can do in the United States.
So the pin is like a little bit of plastic, and then you have the metal
tip
part.
Is metal, yeah. And in
makes it more expensive to manufacture, but also a lot safer.
Yeah. And in the Americas, we just don't have that problem. If you have a small finger and you plug in with your finger in between, you can shock yourself pretty badly.
Yeah. I did that once. You were there.
When you shocked yourself?
Yeah.
By plugging something in?
Oh, no, that was different. Never mind. I won't make you relive that. You feel horribly guilty every time I remind you of it. So.
I don't remember this at all. What are you talking about? Did I shock you?
Yeah, you did.
With what?
You electrocuted me.
I did not electrocute you. You'd be dead. I shocked you. Electrocution is death by electricity.
Really?
Yeah.
Just like grounding is death by water.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Never mind. You did
or
not.
Or by liquid of any form, actually.
But you did zap me. You did zap me.
With a thing that intentionally zaps people or accidentally?
What you did is... Yeah, so you had taken a plug, it was a wire with bare ends and a male Edison on the other end, and you were going to wire something up and plug it in the wall, and you plugged it in the wall without wiring it up and just left it lying there.
On my bench at work?
Yeah. No. This was when we were doing the installation in San Jose in that space.
Why would I have bare wires?
I don't know, but you did.
You sure it was me and not one of the students?
Oh, it was
that
you.
That does not sound
it
like me.
It was you because you immediately owned up and you apologized a lot for it. Because you were, I think that...
What was I wiring?
I don't remember what you were wiring.
Oh, my God. I have no idea. Was this because...
But I was crawling around on the ground trying to, like, you know, get some other wire pulled through some hole or something.
Was this the San Jose show or one of the Santa Cruz shows?
This is San Jose
okay.
show.
So was it when the breakers tripped and we didn't have electricity and I was testing to whether we had power or not? Is that why
no.
I was plugged in?
No.
No, I just had a pair of pairs.
There's... absolutely no good reason.
Maybe that's why. So I was just wiring something like recently like that.
You were like, you said that is so unprofessional and horrible and I could have really hurt you. And you were like, really, you were really upset. And I'm like, dude, I'm fine. Like, I mean, my arm kind of hurts, but I'm fine. Like, I'm okay.
Oh, gosh.
And you're like, I wonder if you got hit by
the... It's typical. It clutches his pearls and completely forgets about it after the fact.
Yeah. You're a really good actor.
I think it's amazing that I've completely blocked this. Have you talked to me about this since that happened? And I've
twice.
Is this the same experience it was last time?
We might have talked about it on the show. Oh, I don't know. I'm not going to go looking for it, but we might
I'm
have.
I'm trying to think of which art piece was it that needed bare wires? Like, what was I doing?
I have no idea.
It could have been lighting.
So if you can't remember that
I can
this happened,
anything about it,
you probably won't remember what art piece it was for. So we can probably
I remember the art pieces pretty well because there was like a lot of writing.
You just
about
don't
them
remember when you almost killed your friend, but like, you know, the art pieces. That was fun.
I'm sorry I shocked you. Okay. Miles, what physical pain have I caused you in our relationship together? You should probably make something up.
I'm actually shocked that you forgot that. So that makes two times. I'm not shocked you forgot that.
I usually injure you, or at least come close to it.
Emotionally?
With words.
No, we were... when I was living in the dome, he was in the back of the pickup truck. A piece of rope caught on the back tire, and I was riding forward, and it started cinching him, and he yelped at me to hit the brakes, and I did, fortunately, quickly enough that he did not lose a leg.
That was probably the most... danger my life was in was that experience.
Not falling out of the tree or anything.
Yeah, the broken back.
Well, that was a brief moment where I was in danger.
The entire time you were up on the tree without the right harness, that all counts, I think.
Okay, let me say this. I was the most scared of the experience from that happening. That was a
like
point where I was like, wow. That totally could have been
a life-changing experience.
Like breaking your back. No, it was one of those situations where, okay, so I'm on top of the whole bunch of brush. We're clearing brush from someplace and moving down the road. And so it's the back of your truck, and we have a tarp on top of that and ropes around. And I'm on top of that tarp kind of holding it down, and we're driving along. Not a big deal, except that, as you said, a truck rope, like a black and orange rope, caught under the wheel, and the truck started riding under the rope. And so as we moved along, it was cinching, and it happened to be over my body.
Yeah.
And so luckily there was a bit of, you know, crunching of the leaves as my body got pressed down. And if you hadn't have stopped, I probably would have been cut by the rope or broken by the rope. It was pretty bad. And I just remember that experience of like completely being trapped. It took a moment, you stopped, and then I was fine. I was like, oh, that could have been when I was part of the Darwin Awards. Like, that was close.
See, this
However, when you had the chainsaw on the ladder, there was no time for you
time,
to think about it.
If I had thought, wow, this is stupid, then I would have been fine. But I didn't think that way, and that is why I broke my back. Yeah.
This is why I only do Geek Speak with you two.
We don't do any
it's
kind
pretty,
of art
it's
installation or
pretty
clear.
Safe. It's just words, which, you know, Miles, you do utilize like knives sometimes, but...
But once you go to sleep,
quite
and the next
skillfully,
day you feel
yeah.
Machetes, thank you very much.
Yeah. Vice President of the Pedantic Society, sure.
Let's do an episode of Geek Speak, shall we?
I thought this was the episode.
Well, yeah, we never really started it.
Oh my God, we really don't have any material today.
What are you talking about?
This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. As you can hear clearly with me in the room, in my son's bedroom with purple walls and a very cute sleeping dog.
Oh, those are purple.
Yeah.
Nice. I like it. It's a good purple.
It's a good purple. I like it too. I like the painting too.
It's
one of my mom's paintings.
It's a light regal purple.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of dark.
In the room with you are...
Mr. Miles Elam. He's a programmer and farmer. Hey, Miles.
How's it going?
Goat herder. And garden maker. And we also have Ben Jaffe, and Ben is a programmer and traveler. And what else? What else can I say about you? You garden too?
Yeah. I'm a crappy human.
No.
Yeah. No. I mean, sorry. No, I learned a lot more about... So I already feel like I knew a decent amount about human perception before I went to this conference called SIGGRAPH. And it's a graphics conference. They talked about also a lot about AR, VR, and everything. And so I learned even more about human perception.
Augmented reality, virtual reality.
Yeah.
Cool.
It was fantastic. I've always wanted to go. It's a very well-known graphics conference. They tend to focus more on 3D graphics, rendering, simulation, that kind of stuff. But all of that stuff is very applicable to augmented reality and virtual reality. And so they had a decent number of presentations about other things that relate to virtual reality, like different ways to...
What was the most surprising thing you learned about our senses?
Oh, a lot of things. The most surprise, that's an expensive query. You're asking me to recount my entire experience and then rank it.
$$, Ben.
I've got a decent number of things I want to talk about, and we can...
As examples.
We can interleave them with his stories, because I don't have any stories.
Okay, well, in that case, let's talk about Mars, shall we?
Sure. Miles. I didn't learn anything about Mars at SIGGRAPH.
No.
No.
We could bring up pareidolia and Mars, though, if we wanted to.
Oh, yeah. There's a mountain range.
Yeah. That looks like a face.
Yeah. And from the right angle.
With the right lighting.
From every other angle, it looks like a mountain.
That's right. All right. Moving on. What else is on Mars?
A rover known as Opportunity. It was a pair originally, Spirit and Opportunity. Opportunity is having some trouble. There is a dust storm on Mars. And when I say a dust storm on Mars, I mean around the entire planet.
Dust storm? Yeah, Mars does not mess around with dust storms. It's like Jupiter and hurricanes. Like, it's kind of a big deal.
Jupiter, the big storms there will tear anyone apart.
Jupiter, the big storms are like many times larger than the planet Earth.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas Mars dust storms, the dust really doesn't have that much heft to them.
Yeah.
The atmosphere is way too tenuous. Yeah. But that dust does occlude the entire planet sometimes.
Mm.
And this is a problem if you have a rover that is solar powered.
Ah, yeah, it's climate changing. So if it's changing the climate of the entire planet. I mean, like, if we had... a lot of people say if we had a large meteorite crash into the Earth, it might not be the meteorite that kills us. It's more likely to be all of the dust that gets kicked up, or the dust that gets kicked off by volcanic eruptions as a result of the thing.
Popularized as the nuclear winter.
Nuclear winter.
In the 80s.
And that kills all the crops because now you don't have sunlight. Sure. In this case, the crop is...
Opportunity.
Now, at the same time, there's been some news around where it talks about, like, oh, my God, NASA is about to lose this, you know, multi-million dollar effort. And in honor of John Tracy, who first brought it up to me, this thing was only meant to be running for 90 days.
And how many years has it been?
We covered the story of Spirit and Opportunity rovers going to Mars around the time that we started with this program, like a few years
like
after that.
16 years ago.
Yeah. It was originally a 90-day mission, and now
it's like if your cat later outlives you, and then you're worried that it's going to pass.
And so
100-year-old cat.
Right. And so the issue is that you can't just put the rover into a sleep mode and then just be like, oh, whatever, if it wakes up next year, it'll be fine. Mars has periods of very cold weather.
Oh, so it needs its power to heat itself.
Like, the highest that Mars ever got would be a cool day for us. But that's like the record heat, like the equivalent of one of those... Right. 130
most
140
of the time,
degree with heat index.
Most of the time it's extremely cold. And so you're saying that it has to have enough power to warm itself?
It has heaters, yes. On the bright side, dust blanketing actually...
Bright side, you see what he did there? Sorry, go on.
Actually helps with this. It actually keeps some of the warmth in.
Oh, okay.
Oh, interesting. So the thing that prevents it from warming itself also keeps it a little warmer than it would be.
Right, but not warm enough.
Oh,
and
right.
There's also the issue of when the dust settles, will that dust be on top of the solar panels?
Okay, so Miles, someone your needs news to bring story it about Mars is not about Opportunity, the thing you have on the website here. It's about something completely different. What's up?
On the contrary, I don't believe it was Mars that first story was about.
Oh.
So I just pivoted.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I was rather. Well,
this is
case,
an opportunity for a segue.
Speaking of opportunities, let's talk about the moon, shall we?
The moon, the other celestial body that is visible with the human eye from Earth.
The sun is visible. Just want to point that out. It's a celestial body.
I didn't say they were the only ones that were visible.
You said the other rather than another.
Yeah, I think that's pedantically true.
Okay. Anyway.
Sorry. I wouldn't correct you, Lyle, if you had said this, but these moments.
Let's see. Saturn, Venus, Mercury, Moon, Mars. I think that's it for naked
eye. Sun.
And
yeah.
The sun.
And the sun.
There you go.
Jupiter.
Didn't I say Jupiter? Did you? Saturn? I thought I said Saturn, Jupiter. Okay, anyway. Yes, those are the ones that you can see with your naked eye. With the help, actually, all the time from the sun.
There have been a few probes that have been sent back and forth, some spacecraft, and trying to figure out what the moon is about. And we do know that the moon is made of many of the same materials as the Earth, or many parts of the Earth.
Parmesan.
And what they have found definitively is proof of water ice. Surface ice.
Surface water ice.
Yes.
On the moon.
On the moon.
Didn't this happen 3 years ago?
I have a question, and I'm actually not being a butthead, but is there a
we'll
reason?
Be the judge of that,
No. I'm actually curious. Is there a reason that you said water ice instead of just ice?
Because there are different types of frozen material that we refer to as ice.
So colloquially, ice is water ice, but there are other things.
And we dry ice, you know, carbon dioxide.
But there are other ices that are dry.
Yeah, I mean, can you call like steel ice? It's frozen liquid. I mean,
steel is, oh my God. Wow.
I mean, I don't know. if ice is kind of water ice, unless you specify that it's a different type of ice.
There are also like frozen hydrocarbons.
So in this context of talking about astronomy or science, saying water ice is actually a little bit more specific than just saying ice.
Ice on the moon. I swear to you, we've covered this story before.
And it has come up before. The problem was, for example, when the spacecraft Clementine went to the moon, it seemed like it found ice as a possibility, but the measurements weren't definitive. They weren't sure if that was what they found or not, or whether it was some, you know, mess up with the data. This time, they feel pretty confident that it is, in fact, ice.
That's so cool. This is much more definitive than previously.
Yes, and not just buried ice, but actually ice crystals on the surface of the moon.
Wow.
That's cool.
Nice.
Nice.
You're all going
all right,
to
let's
hell.
Do, let's do one of those segues, Ben. You were talking about inner slicing some AR VR
speaking
stuff.
Speaking of ice, it doesn't taste like much. Oh, hey, I want to talk about taste. I could get better at my segues.
That was cool, Ben.
Speaking of bad taste, Ben?
this is the mean thing you're talking about, right?
That was beautiful, though.
Would you rather me accidentally shock you or him do that to you every week?
I mean, neither.
That's because you have excellent taste,
but
sir.
Like doing this show, you're not going to accidentally shock me with an XLR cable or something.
You don't
like,
know
that's
that.
That's just not how that works. Like XLR cable is much better designed than the Edison
that's true.
Plug, which is well-named because Edison was a butthead.
You know what I really appreciate about you, Ben? Your ability to stay on topic.
You know, when you said,
about other things now. Let's talk about his goats again.
I have to say, when you said, you know what I really appreciate about you, my brain went, no. No. I'm just sitting and waiting for it.
You know, I don't think it comes across that Miles attacks you very much. You feel that way, though, right?
Well, I don't know. This is a question for the listeners. I don't actually feel attacked or offended right now.
No, not
there,
right now.
There are some times though where, like, so you're a very passionate person, right? And so when, like, there are situations when stories come up, say, about Facebook or something, and I know that you know about this because you used to work at Google, where you might know more about a story, but you can't actually talk about it. You feel this way with Netflix. Mm-hmm. If a story comes up, you're, you know, just
I gotta be more careful, sure.
Yeah, but I think that Facebook and Google in particular get a lot more maybe sharp,
yeah,
negative press directed at them. And so sometimes the intensity of that in covering a story about Facebook that's negative can be both difficult because I can't chime in.
Yeah, you're almost muted a little bit. Like, you're kind of subjugated in what you can say. Yeah,
right. And also it's frustrating because I might know more about it, or I mm-hmm. might know a justification for why something happened, or, you know, whatever. So, I don't know. I think that's the main time that it's ever a problem.
I brought it up because I know that sometimes it's a problem at some level, but yeah. I don't think it comes across that way publicly at all. So now we're kind of joking about that pattern. I don't know if it's like clear that there is that pattern.
Yeah, I get offended by you all the time. On that.
I know.
That's not
and
true.
Let the record show, I did not fire the first shot this evening.
Oh, that's true. I walked in and
that's
I walked around in the threshold of the door and I went, oh, hey, Brian. Oh, it's you.
doesn't hurt so much. You set the tenor for banter.
I hugged you and I very genuinely said, it's really good to see you.
So tell me, what about taste?
Oh, yeah. Okay. This was a demo that I did not try, and you will probably see the reason why.
What it basically was is
taste simulation.
With what? Chemicals or current?
I'll get to that in a second. But the idea is you have this VR headset on, and you've got headphones on. So basically, of all of your senses, you've got vision, you've got sound, hearing, covered. But you've got all of these other senses that are not covered, and a lot of the demos and a lot of the papers were about trying to integrate with some of these other senses, like proprioception, which is the sense of your joints moving, and your vestibular system, which is your balance.
Yeah, yeah. We normally think of those the five senses because the sixth sense.
Oh, there's so many more than five.
There's so many more. Yeah, balance is a great one. It's like, oh yeah, that's there.
Yeah, and then there's obviously smell and taste. And then there's also touch, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this one is talking about taste. And I want to quote from the waiver. In this experiment, a small amount of electrical current will pass through your head.
Is this why you didn't do it?
This is why I didn't do it. The adopted method is similar to blah, 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 blah. Although it's reputably safe, the long-term effects are not completely understood. And then, like, if you're going to be a willing participant, you hereby agree... not to sue any of us. But yeah, basically it's this thing that you strap on your chin and then also an electrode on the back of your neck, and it induces a current, a particular frequency current, as I understand it, to stop your current taste sense.
Okay.
And then it induces another current to induce another taste.
Interesting. Do they then give you something that has a taste to it and then modify that? So you actually have to pick up taste first.
I didn't do it.
Right.
They did have cups, so I imagine they were giving people apple juice or something like that. But that was a pretty cool one. There were also a good number of haptic technologies. Haptic is touch.
Mm-hmm.
So one of them was this directional fingertip dragging demo, where you'd put your finger on this fingertip pad thing, and you'd reach out into this virtual world. You're just looking at a screen, and you'd touch all these different things, and it would do its best to simulate some sort of give you some haptic feedback. And it was interesting because they actually were able to make it directional. So if you were pulling front to back versus left to right, you could actually detect some sort of a difference there.
Left to right versus...
If you're reaching out and you're touching this virtual thing and you're moving left to right versus pushing in and out of the scene.
Okay, gotcha.
That you could actually
feel the difference.
Feel the
direction. And you tried this one.
I did try that one. It wasn't very impressive to me personally, but I did see that there was a differentiation. Also, the time that I demoed it, there were a little bit of problems with the sensor. It kept picking up the other person's hand and stuff like that. So I didn't get the best demo, but it was kind of cool. It's all done with vibration.
That's very cool. The electrical signal thing of changing your taste buds seems to me like what's happening is it's trying to get the same frequency as your taste buds' nerve signals, like whatever your taste buds are firing to your brain to give you taste, it's trying to emulate that frequency.
Yeah.
I would imagine that it could be different per different people.
Right. I was wondering about calibration too. Yeah. Like, do they say, okay, what are you tasting now? What are you tasting now? What are you tasting now?
I wonder if they have an ability to sense it too, just pick up pick up what this frequency is that they want to cancel, if there's a way to sense that. Because it'd be really interesting to see
interesting.
If the reason why people like different tastes is because the signaling is different for each person. Let's say you love blueberries and I love bananas, right?
Yeah.
In reality, the strong signal we get from those are very similar in our brains. And one's banana and one's blueberry.
This is the question that people always ask of, like, does red look the same to you as it does to me? And, like, all of this. And are our brains just calibrated differently?
I love that idea.
Yeah, it is. It's cool.
Hey, can I ask you something about when I shocked you?
Yeah.
Way back.
I didn't taste anything, no.
Ah, darn.
Is that what you're going to ask me?
That's what I was going to ask you.
Oh, okay. No, it was in my arm.
You read my mind.
It was in my arm. This was the time when actually I was dealing with some tendonitis and some repetitive stress injury. So yeah, when I got shocked, it started tensing up and I was a little bit worried about like a regression in my treatment on that arm. But it was actually totally fine. I've now had that experience. I don't regret it. I would do it again. I would not do it again.
Happily, a telescope, a terrestrial telescope, has broken ground and will start construction. It won't be available until the 2020s, 2023 to be exact. It is the Giant Magellan Telescope, located in Chile. Las Campanas Observatory in southern Atacama.
Okay.
And it is slated to be, with its seven smaller flexible secondary mirrors that go back to a central primary mirror, to be approximately 10 times the resolution of Hubble.
Ooh. Cool.
But on Earth.
But high altitude?
Yeah, I mean, most ground telescopes these days are at high altitudes. And it is one of nine telescopes that will be coming online in the next, decade or so.
What spectrum are they?
They range. South Africa has the Meerkat radio telescope, which is multiple dishes that are working on very long wavelengths to see things that have been redshifted quite a bit. You have the European Extremely Large Telescope, also in Chile. The Atacama Desert is one of the driest places on Earth, and so that's one of the reasons why it's a...
it works where for
it's telescope. Really... why am I forgetting the word here?
Atmospherically...
It's really attractive for astronomers because you don't have moisture in the air causing a ripple pattern.
The twinkling of the lights.
Atmospheric.
Well, the twinkling of the lights.
Perturbation.
Yeah, disturbing. The twinkling of the lights will happen because of heat differences. But yes, the heat differences are pronounced when you have water vapor.
Very cool. New telescopes to see new things.
Yeah, the 30-meter telescope and on Hawaii's. I believe it's on the Big Island.
It is. Mauna Kea, yeah. I almost went there because we were there when the... What's the recent meteor shower?
Perseids.
So the Perseids are happening, and I was like, wait a second, we're on Hawaii, and like the best place in the world to watch them is here. So I start researching. Yeah, you have to have a four-wheel drive vehicle, and only a certain amount of vehicles get up there at once. But you can drive to 14,000 feet, which is pretty impressive. I wish I'd planned that out better because that would have been awesome. I did a very low-tech vacation, by the way. 2 weeks, or 1 week in Hawaii, and... I brought a mic with me so I could record some GeekSpeak content, and I did nothing technical. Like,
that's
just
fantastic.
Totally, I didn't bring a laptop. I did do some, you know, video and stuff.
You
with
use
a little,
no technology? No, no pencils?
No, I used technology. I just didn't do anything that was notable to talk about on air, except for, like, chill and enjoy myself and drink coffee.
I just also wanted to mention the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope.
Synoptic?
Also located in Chile. This is a curious one that has a 3.2 billion pixel camera. It's about the size of a small car.
That's a lot of pixels.
So, I'm not talking megapixels. We're talking, that is that gigapixel at that
3.2
point?
3.2 gigapixels?
Yeah.
That's cool. Ben, we talked about taste. We talked about touch.
Miles insulted me.
I was talking about SIGGRAPH.
That's not newsworthy.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So, gosh, what should I? There was a decent amount, actually, about autonomous driving. Autonomous driving simulation and visualization, that kind of stuff.
Cool.
Like,
what do you feel about it?
We get in
a self-driving car right now. And
driving itself. It wasn't so much about, like, hey, look, we're self-driving. Like, there were a lot of companies that had presences there, and one company gave a talk about kind of what they're doing. But a decent amount about, like, how do you visualize what the car is doing, right? It was cool to see the ways that they are visualizing this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now you can see it better. I don't know. Yeah. Like, it's hard to compare it to something because there's nothing to compare it to.
Do you remember in the episode Next Gen, and I know you do, where Geordi gets a transmitter on the side of his optics, and they're able to transmit them back to the ship?
Are you talking about Star Trek Generations, the movie?
No, Star Trek Next Generation.
Next Generation episode.
Oh, okay.
What is that halo is that around Data?
Oh, he's because he's
in. LaForge to Bridge.
This is the Enterprise.
Captain, I'm switching on the transmitter.
Ready to receive. This on main viewer.
Aye, sir.
You don't remember this episode?
I do.
Okay.
Now I do. The movie is another...
The movie has that too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the Klingons, the
Lursa and Betor. Thank you.
Lursa and Betor Duras. Yeah, the Duras sisters. Thank you. I had to say the names. Kidnap Geordi and spoiler alert.
The movie's been out for like 10 years. I think we're okay.
They have his visor. 10 years. We are that old.
They have his visor transmit back, and then they get the shield modulation frequencies, and then their torpedoes can go through the shields.
Geordi, what's that? Over to the left.
What?
Yes, that. No, back. Yes, that. Right there. What is that?
That's Commander Riker.
Ah, to me it's just an undefined form standing in a visual frenzy. Can you filter out the extraneous information?
No, I get it all simultaneously.
But it's just a jumble. How can you make head or tail of that?
I select what I want and then disregard the rest.
But how is that possible?
Well, how in a noisy room can you select one specific voice or sound?
Of course. Something you learn.
Exactly. Something I've learned. Does that make it more clear?
Look over at Data. There's an aura around him.
Well, of course, he's an android.
But you say that as if you think that's what we all see.
Don't you?
Sir, I hate to break this up, but,
Oh, yes, of course, number one, proceed.
Let's go.
When the visualization happens in the episode, which is like second
right.
season or something like that,
yeah.
And they're seeing through his eyes, they do a lot to add extra stuff. The halo
yeah.
around the android, an obvious thing,
mm-hmm.
but they do a lot of other stuff that's just kind of probably noise, like probably just artistic merit.
Yeah.
But I always, but the idea being that he can see things that are outside our spectrum,
yeah, right.
like glowing androids, but other things as well. And I've always thought of that problem, and it's kind of like when people talk about the idea of having multiple arms. So you'd be like Doc Ock, and he's got eight limbs,
yeah.
right? How does your brain add extra stuff to your sensory input? How could you potentially have more senses? And there's actually an example of this that actually I think we covered years ago on the show, where you can put magnets in silicon beads that can spin and put them in your fingers, and then you can actually start feeling current, pretty high-level current. But eventually, you actually don't think of it as, oh, something's buzzing in my hand. You start thinking about, oh, there's current in this wire. Like, you, your brain does translate sensory input into real sensory input. For what? For the wire that shocked when you. No, actually, there's no current flow in that wire. It was just sitting there, so you wouldn't be able to sense
it. Right. That's a good point. Another interesting thing, going briefly back to haptic feedback, several companies were trying to do haptic feedback using fans, actually. So you would, like, for example, you'd hold this thing that's supposed to be a VR gun, right? You're holding this VR gun. Every time you pull the trigger, the fans push away from your hand and push it back.
So and a lot of fans.
A lot
like
of
jet fans.
Yeah, like little jet fans, large jet fans. So, you know, in a way, it's cool because you get a, you get this physical, like, I guess, blowback of the virtual gun that you wouldn't be able to get any other way. On the other hand, every time you shoot something in the real world, it goes and it sounds so annoying. It's it's awful. So I would never want to be in the same house as someone playing that game with that hardware. But it's an interesting proof of concept. Another person, another group had this barbell. And they had attached fans on either end. And so you would lift the barbell and you'd put it back down and you'd put weights on the barbell and lift it. And the fans would activate and it would feel heavier. That's kind of an interesting thing.
So no, the thing only had fans on it. The weights were in the virtual space.
Yes, exactly.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Of course, that breaks down. If you accidentally rotate the barbell, then now your fans are going the opposite direction or going a different direction. Anyway, it's just some kind of cool air feedback to give haptic feedback.
Yeah.
Of course, the problem is it breaks the sound piece of it.
Yeah.
But really neat. Yeah, a lot of people doing some somewhat novel things. I have one more, but it's going to be a significantly longer segment, so I think maybe we'll toss it back to Miles first.
We also have a longer segment now for Miles at some level, but I think it's a pretty interesting one. Let's talk about car manufacturers and what's changing and what's a little challenging in the new space.
How often do we think about auto insurance, the industry itself, how it works?
Oh, how it works?
Yeah, because we pay a certain amount of money, you know, a certain amount. So you have actuarial studies done on here's the car, here's the rate that someone has an accident with it, here's how we're going to pay out, here's
what the kind of car, what area, what the grades of their 16-year-old son actually are. Luckily, mine has good grades.
Right. Now, with most cars, even if a car is totaled, considered a loss, there are many pieces that will still be salvageable from it. And so insurance companies, when they, you know, a car can't be driven as is, they can still sell it off for parts and recoup much of that cost and therefore keep the rates low or, you know, take
a
profit from it.
So they call it totaled and they give you the money necessary to buy a new vehicle and then they take that vehicle and sell pieces of it.
Right.
So totaled means not drivable, not useless.
Not useful in its current state, but the parts can be used to supplement other
vehicles. I totally understood what you said, Ben.
Yeah.
Go on.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anyway.
He's trying to make me look stupid, everyone.
This?
I don't know. You're like, you
okay,
know,
go on.
This rivalry is not...
I'm so trying not to escalate right now.
I'm going to come and hug you while you cover the story.
So with regard to Teslas, it's a different story. Teslas, when they have an accident, the parts are so highly computerized that they don't tend to be usable after the fact.
That's not true. What do you mean so computerized are not useful? Like printer cartridges?
Are you aware that the door has a separate firmware from the rest of the car?
Oh, interesting. So
why? Sorry, what were you going to say, Ben?
No, I mean, that's
a pretty valid question. Why,
that's a really
valid question.
Why does
the door have a firmware?
If you want to update, the door does have electronics. Like, it does have things like the handle that pops out. And
let's name it all. What all the things does it do?
The side view mirrors will slide in.
The mirrors, of course, also move up and down, and you know, can aim the mirrors.
And they have their own firmware.
Right. The door unlocks the controls for the, you know, there's lots of stuff in there. But normally that's a wire harness in the door that goes through a cable that goes to the computer. You're saying in a Tesla, there's a computer on there, just a serial line to the door. Or is it Wi-Fi?
No, it's not Wi-Fi, but there's Bluetooth. Basically firewalled communication between these components. The idea being that if you can't get control of one, like get control through the door to then access the steering system or the braking system.
So having them be separated components, in a sense, separates out potential escalation of privileges attacks.
Sorry, I'm just imagining my first car, which is like a Toyota truck with no, well, there's probably like a little bit of computer in there. But the doors definitely didn't have computers in them. Yeah. I don't think there was any electricity in the door. It was all manual. And I didn't go, oh, I'm glad nobody can crack my door and break into my computer of my car. Okay,
well,
go on.
It also makes firmware updates simpler. The firmware for just a door is going to be much easier than having a big firmware system where you have to keep track of all the different discrete pieces.
It doesn't need to have its own processor. Obviously, a door doesn't need to have its own processor. It could just be a wiring harness.
When you say processor, and at the same time, think
if it's a firmware, it's a processor. I mean,
yes, sure. but think of like an Arduino that you pay less than $5 for. Like,
processor
technically,
used
it's
to...
a processor, but it's not. Yeah. It's not like something on our laptop.
It used to be that you would say like this is a computer, and that meant something like this is actually kind of expensive. But now you say this is a computer, and it could be like a $3.
Yeah.
You know, integrated circuit that actually has way more power than my phone did back in the 90s.
You see that light switch on the wall?
Yeah.
That's off right now because there are noisy lights in
this
room?
Got its own firmware?
It has its own firmware. I mean, yeah. I was trying to fix one because it broke. And yeah, it's got a processor in it. My light switches have processors in them.
Fun fact, the cell phone that you have in your pocket will have anywhere from 2 to 8 times as much computing power as the entire render farm of the original Toy Story movie.
Yeah. Yeah. My phone in my pocket, which is an iPhone 10, is more powerful than my MacBook Air laptop.
Because that way it costs over $1,000.
Probably.
At any rate, so here's the trouble. All of these discrete parts go into lockdown after an accident. They can't be immediately repurposed.
So when an accident happens, the firmware gets locked down. For what? Why do they do that?
Well, here's the deal. One, they do it just because they don't want to have the liability. And I'll get into that in just a moment. But with regard to Tesla, they don't want to use salvage parts. They're selling new cars. They don't really have that used market per se. And with regard to salvagers, like a lot of times you'll go and you buy a car that's, you know, at the salvage auction, really cheap, get it for parts, and then you can assemble a whole new car sometimes. Like you take 3 broken cars and you can get enough parts to make one working car for less than the price of a new car if you have the relevant expertise. Teslas, the first ones, just like any car, is going to have a certain number of accidents. And the first ones, the first Model S's, for example, were bought up very quickly for a fair amount of money. Their competitors wanting to tear it apart, see how it works, what they did, things like that. And then they had a very precipitous price drop at the salvage market because you couldn't really fix it. A lot of cars, there'll be an owner's manual, but they're becoming fewer and fewer. With regard to a Tesla, you really need an owner's manual, but you don't have one. And Tesla is not in a huge hurry to help salvagers to say, hey, here's how to do a rootkit on our system, or here's how to, you know, jailbreak our system in order to get it working again. From Tesla's point of view, it's a liability. If someone does a salvage and then that car goes back on the road and then gets into an accident, or it's put together improperly, burn someone's house down. The news story won't be salvager improperly put a Tesla back together and burn someone's house down. It's going to be Tesla burned house down.
From an economics perspective and a capitalistic perspective, there's not much incentive for Tesla to say, and our cars are repairable. they're obviously being sold to people that are not going to be building their own cars, most likely.
Yeah. But this does add to the insurance cost for Tesla, because the insurance companies cannot recoup those parts that they could before.
I see. So now the insurance basically on the vehicles has to be a lot higher because they're not going to get any money back from the pieces.
Right. So this is a story that was reading from Fast Company about a guy who learned how to salvage and jailbreak and moving along to make a new Tesla.
I watched a whole video about him and how he's been collecting Tesla parts and figuring out and learning a lot about how the vehicles work.
Right.
But
and sharing that information with others.
Oh, yeah.
And so he can do a Model S and do a Model X. He's now one of the few people that knows how to, or at least has gotten a fair way with jailbreaking, is the best way to describe it, jailbreaking a Model 3.
Mm-hmm. The other thing he was dealing with is the battery packs. These battery packs are rightly extremely dangerous, right? They're
Anytime you have a large battery. Just...
But pretty interesting, the idea also that if you own a vehicle, and of course, if you've repurchased a destroyed vehicle from an insurance company, rather, you've bought the vehicle, you do own it. You have all rights to do anything you want with it. Like, we're pretty clear in that kind of American ingenuity perspective that, yes, you can repair the things you own. The rules, for example, about...
That is not universal throughout the United States.
No, it's not. Yeah. But we've seen cases of it be, you know, fought in court. Like, for example, the ability to unlock your phone, right? Like, you can take your phone and say, hey, even though I bought it with this carrier, after a period of time, because I'm not in the contract anymore, please unlock it so I can use it on any carrier. Because this whole idea is that you own it, you should be able to do things you want with it. And that keeps on showing itself in court. Now, of course, John Deere fights this tremendously hard so that they can offer software-only upgrades, which also Tesla has software-only upgrades, right? You actually have some feature in the vehicle that you haven't paid for, even though the vehicle sometimes has capabilities, you can't actually access it without paying Tesla more money.
Which also brings up another aspect, which is if you can jailbreak, can you then tap into those software upgrades and mess up the channel? If you make changes to it, does Tesla have some type of liability then, because it's an auto system? When someone makes any changes to it, it's not like your phone. It's like the worst thing that happens when you jailbreak your phone is that you void the warranty, maybe you blow out a speaker, you know, something like that. With a car, you can kill someone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, if you modify a car, it is your problem. Like, you are, for example, my Leaf, I can actually go and modify the firmware so that I can drive backwards the same speed as I can drive forwards, because there's actually nothing, there's no transmission difference. It's the system's connected to the wheels, right? So
reverse the polarity and the motor goes the other way.
You theoretically, the only reason the vehicle taps out at whatever speed it taps out in reverse is because the software is saying, don't do that. So you can modify that and go 60 miles an hour backwards.
Do people do this?
People have. It's not safe because you can't steer it, right? If you steer incorrectly, you're going to flip the vehicle. But it's more that those capabilities do exist. And in general, though, you know, what a manufacturer is required to do with a vehicle versus what your vehicle is required to do is different. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when my vehicle has a noise inducer at low speeds because the vehicle is so quiet. So there is a speaker in the car that makes kind of a whiny sound when it's driving slowly. So if I come up behind somebody and I'm, you know, coming through a crosswalk, or they're walking across, they can't hear my vehicle, except for my vehicle has a speaker, and the speaker's kind of going, whee, kind of louder than that. Mm-hmm. It's annoying. You can silence it. Nissan had to put it in the vehicles. Tesla have these as well to make a little bit of noise to make it safer. But
hybrids have that as well.
Yeah, but a person can deactivate that thing, and they, I don't think, will get fined. There's no legality for their vehicle to have to do that, but the vehicle has to have that on when it's sold. So what he's doing, though, is reusing this technology, of course, I think most people would agree is a good idea. It seems silly that you get in an accident with a Tesla, and all these features of the Tesla are totally valid, except the software saying you can't run anymore. That seems like a waste from a technical perspective. It seems like a waste of resources on the planet.
Sure it is. And like I said, it's a PR standpoint. We've covered stories before where it talks about, you know, a Tesla burst into flames. It's like, yeah, But how many different cars on the road regularly every year burst into flames? Yeah. Like, it's not an uncommon occurrence, or not uncommon enough among gasoline vehicles. And yet, because it was a Tesla and it's new and it's novel and they tout safety features for it, it is named in the news. Yeah.
This happens very commonly for high-profile companies, right? You'll get any headline that has Tesla in the name of the headline, or Netflix or Facebook in the headline, you just get more readers. So any story is a story that gets written. Like, that's just kind of one of the side effects of being an attractive name. I don't think it's necessarily just about PR, though, and about the risk they have in PR. It's also about the investment in time and energy to make things reusable, to make things documented. I mean, just take a very simple thing like a interface for, you know, some kind of API for a software interface. If I've published an API to some system like Google Search or something, and I've said, this is how you can use Google Search through API, I now have that published responsibility to update it, to keep it documented, all these things. If I don't say that, and it's there, but I don't document it, I don't share about it, and someone writes an interface on it, it's a lot easier for me to change that thing over time. So in some regards, when you make a commitment to make the system be available for people to do what he's doing, you have to invest resources to make that occur. And so it's not just the PR, it's also investing resources to make it have a friendly market of reusability.
Yep.
Thank you, Miles, for the Tesla and rebuilding story. I think he's succeeding so far. He keeps on doing more work. He's been fixing things for people. And yeah, it sounds like a kind of neat market.
Yeah, I hope that the right to repair movement really takes off. And on that note, hey, Apple, stop soldering the storage on your main boards.
Does your laptop there have a soldered on memory?
My laptop does not, actually. It's the last model that... it's not the last model that didn't. Later ones did have that proprietary socket.
Yeah.
In there.
I don't think this is a fight you're going to win.
But yeah, huh?
The next Intel processors, the next versions, are going to have soldered on heat sinks for desktop machines. So.
Okay.
Well, I know. It's not a big deal, but they're trying to eke all the performance out there they can, and soldering on a heat sink is more efficient than using paste.
But NVMe is a thing. And it's just as fast as their, yeah, anyway.
Ben, what was the other thing that struck your fancy at Sigthrath?
I want to talk about redirected walking.
What?
Oh, what? So I was talking before about all of the various ways that we have to sense the world, right? You have hearing, you have vision. I did mention vestibular and tactile and proprioception.
And taste.
And taste, and now I've got to say the other one, hearing. And yeah. But anyway, I want to talk a bit about proprioception and vestibular. So proprioception is feeling yourself walking or moving, right? The states of your joints and your ankles, and also kinesthesia. And then vestibular is all of the inner ear stuff. Sensing linear acceleration and rotational movements and accelerations.
The whole body movement one just reminded me of yoga. So it's like what you're doing when you're doing yoga.
Yeah, what
like
you're doing.
Feeling it, thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. So we've got these various solutions to solve the problem of how do you move in a virtual environment, right? So some people came up with, okay, well, you're holding this controller and you can move your character by moving the controller, right? Which is a pretty unexciting and not very creative way of solving this problem. It's also not very satisfying either, moving a controller around versus moving in the world, right?
I've also seen treadmills that are multi-directional treadmills.
Yeah, I was going to bring that
up. Okay, cool.
Weird-looking treadmills or walking platforms. They're basically 2D treadmills, right?
Yeah.
It's a treadmill made of treadmills. And one of the sets, the whole set of treadmills move, let's say, left to right. And then there's a treadmill made of those side-to-side treadmills, which goes forward and backward. And those things
you have to be tethered at the waist so that you don't fall off of them.
Expensive, first of all,
yeah.
And very complicated. They can break, but there's a lot of really great research being done with these walking platforms. Also, they have to be elevated because your treadmill of treadmills the treadmills have to go underneath, right, come back around the other side behind you. So you've got these strange-looking treadmills. Now, the other thing about these treadmills is that when you start walking, just imagine a normal one-dimensional treadmill, okay? Like a standard running treadmill or something, okay?
I understand that you're representing a line, so it's one dimension.
Yeah.
But it's not a one-dimensional.
It's a three-dimensional treadmill representing one dimension of motion. Yes. So let's imagine that you wired it up. So when you walk forward, it's like, oh, you're going to run into the control panel, so I'm going to turn myself on, right?
Yeah.
And push you backwards.
The idea that you're going to stay in one place, even if you run forward or backward, yes, you'd stay in one place, kind of.
There's a YouTube channel called Smarter Every Day, and this guy, Destin Sandlin, I think is his name, he does all of these videos, and he has a video about 2D treadmills. And he kind of talks about the complexity of solving this problem, of like trying to figure out where the user is going to go, even when the user doesn't know where they're going to go. You want to keep the user in the center of the treadmill so that way they don't fall off if they accelerate in a direction you don't expect. But the problem is that when the user starts, if you imagine a normal treadmill again, right? You start walking forward. Now the treadmill has to accelerate you backwards, and so you feel the treadmill pushing you backwards.
From your feet.
It doesn't feel like you're walking forward.
Right.
It feels like you're walking forward and then being pushed back to the same location.
Right.
Even if your eyesight's, covered.
And all those senses about your joints moving and stuff can feel where your center of balance is and what's happening, and you know it's not the same as
working
forward.
That's your vestibular system, right? Your inner ear. Mm-hmm. So your inner ear is like, whoa, something wonky is happening. Your joints are like, hey, we're walking. And your vestibular system is like, whoa, something's going on. It doesn't feel like I'm just normally walking, right? So how do you solve that? Well, along with this, by the way, there are other strange-looking treadmills which are not treadmills. They're basically giant hamster balls. They go inside of this giant hamster ball that can roll in any direction, but you have the same problem. As you run, you step forward, and your foot lands slightly higher, and then the hamster ball rotates, and your whole body has to get used to this new way of walking. That's not cool. So
I don't know. A giant hamster ball is pretty cool, but go on. It doesn't work as well as you want.
But you're in a virtual environment. You're not in a giant hamster ball.
Oh, I see.
Like, I would go in a giant hamster ball and run around for a while. That'd be cool.
I don't even need goggles.
But if you're wearing a headset, that's tricky. So other people doing research about, like, okay, let's say you have a huge room, like an aircraft hangar or a football field or something like that. You put the person in the middle. You put a headset on them. They can walk around in all of these different directions. They've got this total freedom of movement. They're actually walking. So their sensory perception is consistent with what's going on in the virtual world, right? So you're basically totally able to trick them.
So you're saying that holodecks have to be really, really big.
The problem is you need a really, really big thing. So yeah, actually, this is one of the questions is, like, a holodeck, is it a treadmill? Like, the holodeck, okay, God, you got me started. Holodecks, you've got inertial dampers. Inertial dampers are basically like gravity machines. And so they could actually accelerate you backwards and use the inertial damper to pull you backwards. And then you don't perceive yourself accelerating backwards.
You're saying that they've got the perfect treadmill. Just move the body anywhere in space they want.
They could make the perfect treadmill, yeah. Right. But let's just leave Star Trek aside for a second.
Because that's fake. Yes.
The problem with this technique, and it's a big one, is you need an aircraft hangar.
Per each person.
Per person.
Virtual reality, taking more footage or yes, more space is necessary.
It's almost as bad as golf. But don't get me started on that. Because the course to golf ball ratio.
Okay, so you're in a giant space like that, though, you want to have fake walls. And so there's other problems to solve.
Oh, sure. But let's imagine you don't have walls. For a moment. Okay. Actually, no. Let's imagine. Well, okay. So one of the things that you might want to do is interact with a wall. You walk through a door or something like that. You can actually, like, reach out, open a physical door, right?
Right.
So you do that, right? Let's imagine that in your virtual, just imagine like a square room, perfectly square room in your mind. Maybe close your eyes and imagine, if you're driving and listening to this, don't close your eyes. But you're in the square room, and in one of the corners, on one of the walls, you've got a door, okay? The person walks in through that door. They walk to the opposite corner. They interact with the screen or do something. And then they turn around, and then they exit the door, but the door has moved to the other wall.
Why is it moving
in the
wall?
Same corner? Just imagine that it has.
Okay.
The human will not notice. Because when you walk into a room, unless it's like your house or something, when you walk into a room you're unfamiliar with, you walk in through the door, and then your brain just throws away the information of what wall the door was on. So what you can do is you can effectively rotate the virtual environment 90 degrees by using the same door. It's in a different location, though.
I get that you're. So that's I get one that your way. Brains, our brains are really interesting mapping systems and really kind of cool with this kind of ability. Yeah. The side effect of this, of course, is that when you think you want to say something and you go to another room and you forget what you're going to say or mm-hmm. what you're going to do when you move into a room, that happens because our spatial setting, our spatial mapping gets reset sometimes when you move through doorways.
Yeah.
So it actually is a psychological, physical reaction that occurs in your body. But you can't. At some level, if I'm paying attention and I go like, oh, the door's over to my left.
If you're paying attention, sure.
Sure. So sometimes it's going
to
be necessary.
But people are not going to pay attention
to
just the
door. So you're kind of saying that in this giant hangar, you could have a whole bunch of objects around.
Yeah. So okay. High level, the thing I'm talking about here is the fault tolerance of the body.
Yeah.
So we make an assumption when we interact, and this is not conscious. This is baked into us evolutionarily. We assume that reality is fairly static. We assume that when we walk into a room and we turn around, the door is not going to move. And so when the door does move, we turn around, we see that door, and we think, oh, it must have been there, if we even notice at all.
Yeah.
It may be that just that our brain throws away the information. But the other thing that I'm going to say about all of the things that I'm talking about here and going forward, the researchers kept repeating when they were talking about this, this works on everyone. It works on us. It works on everyone. You know, like it seems like it wouldn't, but it does.
That's awesome.
So all of this is about how we're fault tolerant, right?
What's wonderful is that how would you really know this works on everyone unless you have a virtual space that you can do this in?
Yeah.
Right? Because so it'd be really hard to do it physically.
This is all based on experiments that they've run around this stuff.
See, this actually ties into something from earlier on in the show where we talked about, do two people see the same orange? We're seeing kind of evidence that we do perceive things the same way, uh-huh. that there is a commonality there. We have the same physical structures. We have the same processing. Mm-hmm. So maybe we do all see the same orange.
Well, maybe.
There was a session about color, and that was one of the conclusions I drew from it, too. And it was a deep dive on color, psychoacoustic, physical, neurological.
As I started having children and I started seeing their ability to eat things, what they could eat and stuff and what they're interested in, I realized that the flavors that I like as an adult, the spicier, hotter stuff, is because I have less taste than they do. Another example of this is that I like onions. Some people don't like onions. Our friend Al, friend of the show, one of the geeks sometimes, he tastes onions differently than we taste onions. Genetically, he does.
Cilantro is a thing.
That cilantro thing is also
asparagus.
Do you like cilantro?
It's okay. It's not. I'm in the middle. I'm weirdly in the middle.
Miles, you have something you can't. Yeah, you can't smell the smell that
asparagus makes when you pee it,
right?
I haven't noticed it anyway. I had like a side-by-side of pee, but then I don't want to volunteer for that.
You can't genetically smell it.
I certainly can.
You can. Yeah, I can too. Mm-hmm. I can smell when it's not even there. That's how good I'm smelling it. My point is that we do
may have a different problem, Lyle.
Don't you smell it all the time?
Yeah. It's everywhere. Like asparagus. It's everywhere.
My point is that we do have physical differences that that influence our tastes, right? Like Al's never going to like the onion stuff that I like. Not because the flavor of onion is too strong. What are that? No, it's because physically he's tasting something that I'm mm-hmm. not tasting.
Yeah, and there are things like that around color perception and stuff. But I don't think that's really the question that people often raise. It's like, when you see red, do I see the same? Do I perceive the same
thing?
Yeah, does it look the same to me? Even though I know that like this hardware in my eyeball and this same hardware in your eyeball is activated in the same way, does our brain perceive it in the same way?
Right, and then the whole physical
raises a whole
like theoretical question of like, yeah, when you think of the thing of blue, you can't think of anything but blue. So
Right.
It's possible that it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Okay. I've got more things to get through here. Here's the one that really got me thinking. This talk was called Redirected Walking.
Cool.
Okay. So, you know, I mean, I guess like treadmills are kind of redirecting walking, or it's more like you're moving the person to compensate for their walking, right? It's not really redirected walking. It turns out have you ever closed your eyes when you're walking in a straight line, and then you open your eyes and you find that you have not been walking in a straight line, even though you were pretty sure you were walking in a straight line? Or vice versa, you think, oh, I think I'm veering off to the side, I'm not really sure. You open your eyes and you're walking in a perfectly straight line.
Does it count if I turn a light off in a long room and I go, oh, that's the path I'm going to take, and I go for it and I stub my toe? Is that kind of the same thing?
Yeah.
Because I had a path that was direct and then I deviated from it.
Yeah. So basically, in the way that we physically move, we are not actually as accurate as we think we are. And the way that we can be accurate is by constantly adapting, sure. Right? And the way we adapt is by viewing the world typically with our eyes. We might reach out with our hands in a hallway or something.
And our inner ear.
And our inner ear, sure. But the big one is our eyes. Like when we navigate the world, we really rely on our eyes, assuming that we grew up with the visual sense. So
you're saying is you walk in a straight line because you're always compensating for it?
I mean,
you're adjusting, micro adjusting.
That's a way. Yeah, cool. You're making these micro adjustments. So the technique is, what if someone has a headset on and as they're walking in a straight line, you slowly rotate what they're seeing, entire world around them.
Just slightly as they move.
And then they think, oh no, I'm walking in a curve. And so then they compensate.
But importantly, in the other direction, they don't think that. Their body does that because they're not conscious of it at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're just like, oh, I am walking in a curve and I want to walk in a straight line. But they're actually walking in a straight line. So they start walking in a curve when they compensate.
So you really could have a giant warehouse with a whole bunch of doors and just slightly rotate and only put people at doors when there's supposed to be a door there.
Sure. So
that is awesome.
For a moment, let's forget the doors.
Okay.
And let's say that it's just a flat surface, right? You can make people walk in a straight line in the virtual environment indefinitely, and they're actually just walking round and round in a circle.
In a circle. How big a room do they need then?
So it depends. So when they were doing initial research in this, in 2005, about 57 meters square. Really big room. Big room.
But
in 2010, there was some research that brought it down to 22 meters square. 2012 research got it down to 15 meters square. And recent research in 2016 got it down to 12 meters square.
What?
So if you have a room that's 12 meters by 12 meters, you can have someone in a virtual environment using these techniques walking in a straight line in a circle.
Okay, that's amazingly cool.
Yeah.
So if you just basically have to write the software such that they're always adjusting to put the person in the middle of the room as much as they can.
Your VR headset knows exactly where it is in the space.
Yeah.
And so you have some pretty good location data on it. And as they walk, you just rotate.
I would imagine that you write your game in your virtual environment and everything, and you also write some subroutines that basically try to get the person always in the center.
Yeah.
And you don't have to think about it.
Yeah.
Now, you're going to have a problem if you have two people in the same space. Then you get a serious problem.
Oh, sure. Like, a lot of this breaks down if you add, multiple elements.
I would imagine velocity has something to do with this as well.
I mean, how fast you can run.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to be running. Yeah. So there are obviously constraints and there are things, but in their particular controlled way of doing this research, right? So one idea is, let's imagine that you have in the virtual environment a long straight hallway and a bunch of rooms that come off the left side of the hallway. And they're supposed to go from room to room to room. That straight hallway can be a curve. You can actually have walls. So you have a curved hallway that they're walking down that they think is straight. And every room they go into is the same room. And maybe there's a table in the middle of each of these rooms. And the table is the same table. But it's a different table.
I've seen this movie.
Yeah. But you think it's a different one. I mean, if you had some people in the space, they could actually change the things on the table as you move from quote-unquote room to room.
And what if you were in a virtual train station and you ran down the tracks and you ended up at the same train stop.
Is that a reference to some popular culture thing I don't know about?
I watched the movie with you, I think, actually.
I'm sure I did watch that with you, but
Matrix Revolutions.
That was the one you electrocuted Miles. Do you remember that?
I remember electrocuted Miles.
So, that's cool. There's more. So, you can combine a lot of these things, right? So, you can... Yeah, oh, actually, one of the other examples, just briefly on the redirected walking thing, is they said, imagine that you have a room. You walk into the room through the door, and then you walk to the opposite corner, and you sit down in a chair that's there. That chair might actually be in a different corner of the room, if the room's sufficiently big, because they can arc you to wherever the chair is in the room, and you think that you're sitting in the chair that's across the room, but it's actually off to the left or off to the right.
I totally get what you could do with the right software to make this work.
Right.
I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah. So, there's one more piece, which is, and this again speaks to the fault tolerance of humans and the general stability of reality, is many times a minute, we become blind.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because we blink.
Yes.
And it turns out that if you blink, and yes, during the blink, all of reality rotates slightly around you, when you open your eyes and everything has shifted a little bit, you don't notice.
Of course not. Why would you?
Why would you?
That's great. So obviously, not even when you're moving, they can adjust reality. Just as they, as you blink, they just shift it around.
Yeah, you're just standing there. I mean, like, obviously, if you do this too much, people are going to be like, wait, my feet, why are my feet off to the side now? But you can actually, like, people are really fault tolerant. And so a lot of this is about figuring out where is that threshold of tolerance? Yeah. Like, how much can you push it before people feel like, wait, I'm walking straight, but I really feel like I'm walking in a circle. And it turns out you can push it pretty far. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say that the other times when we're blind regularly, people that have sight are blind regularly, is when they move their eyes from left to right. When
Saccades.
They move their eyes around. Yeah.
Saccades.
Do you want to describe that for us?
Yeah. So, oversimplifying, you have fixations, which is when your eyeballs are looking at a thing. And then you have saccades, which are when your eyeballs move to look at a different thing. And if you just pay attention to your experience right now, as you're, you know, looking around the world, you will find yourself moving your eyeballs all the time to jump across to, like, look at this part of the road or look at that part of the road or look at the dashboard on your car if you're driving or whatever. It turns out that your brain does not process visual input during saccades. And there may be some subtlety here. And if you are a vision scientist and you know the subtlety,
let us know.
Please do let us know. But as far as I understand it, you don't process visual input. Now, you don't see blackness during a saccade because your brain fills in the gaps based on what it knows about the world and what it has seen before. But you don't process visual input. So if you have a headset that has an eye tracker that can detect when you blink and detect every saccade that you make, saccades, I believe, can be between 20 milliseconds and 200 milliseconds. That's off the top of my head, but I think that's about right.
The wonderful thing is it feels like this doesn't happen, but it's pretty easy with eye tracking software and like a light on your screen that every time your eyes move, the light can blink.
Yeah.
And so you won't see the light blink ever, but it's happening.
Uh-huh.
And someone next to you can see it and they're like, yeah, blink to blink to blink every time you move your eyes.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So
during saccades, even if you have someone who never blinks, you know, everyone has that friend. That person uses it, and every time they move their eyes, reality can shift just a little bit.
And of course, when the eye is moving, it makes sense to shift a little bit, because why not?
Yeah. You don't know exactly where your eyeball is going to land, because as it turns out, if you hold, again, don't do this if you're driving, but if you hold your thumb out in front of you, have you done this? Hold your thumb out in front of your face and look at your thumbnail. That thumbnail, that area, is about the area that you have high-resolution vision.
Right.
Everything around is not actually high resolution. Even though it looks like it is, that's just your brain filling in all the gaps. And the longer you're aware of this, the more you can actually start to see, like, oh yeah, actually, I think I know what's out there. I think I know what those curtains off to the side look like.
Examples of this is like there's no color detection in your periphery, or very low color detection in your periphery. So if you have somebody has like a two pens are exactly the same except for their color, they have to be the same shade. You can actually show a person the green and the green and the green from the right-hand side.
And your periphery.
And then eventually show the red pen, and the person will think it's the green pen because they've never seen the green pen, right? That kind of amazing qualities of it.
So to kind of summarize this particular talk, there are so many different ways that you can rotate the world, and by rotating the world, you're effectively rotating your physical environment the opposite direction by that amount. And using all of these techniques together, you can, especially if you're in a somewhat constrained map or a particular use case or something, you can apply these things in really interesting ways to utilize a physical space that's way smaller than the virtual space.
Do you think really that's what cool ghosts stuff. Are doing?
Ghosts?
Yeah.
I mean, can you put a headset on a ghost? Is that what you're asking?
No, it's just kind of joking that like...
If you try, you'll break your headset. It'll fall to the ground.
There's all these side effects that we have. Like, we're repainting the world all the time. We have to recreate it whenever our eyes move. Like, whenever you enter a new room, you're not really sure what room you came in. Your brain just accepts. There's all this stuff that's happening that we're doing a lot of research and investigating and playing with. And then people think... Oh, well, I saw it, though. It must be real. Like, yeah, but you're not really seeing most of what you see anyway.
So this brings me to my existential crisis, as at SIGGRAPH. And so many... fundamentally, what is... From a technological perspective, what is VR? What is AR? Like, what is motion graphics, even? You're trying to find ways... So motion graphics, you're trying to find ways to show... a human visual input that will trick them into believing a thing, that the Incredible Hulk destroyed a building in New York City or whatever, right?
You're putting a lot of judgment on the word trick. Convince.
Am I? No, trick.
Okay.
You are trying to manipulate the person into believing a thing that they don't believe. Now, it's pretty easy in a movie theater to not get lost in the movie because you just need to turn to the person next to you. Right. You're like, oh, there's a person eating popcorn. There's a person who really doesn't know how to eat ice cream next to me. Like, that breaks you out of the moment, right? Or you have to pee. And you can't because you're sitting in a movie theater. Like, all of these things can break you out of it, right? I have trouble getting lost in movies sometimes. But VR, it was actually it was really easy. I put on a headset. None of these additional techniques or anything. I just had a headset on and some headphones, and I was standing, floating in space, and I had these stupid looking controllers that I could see, and I touched the controllers to each other, and in the virtual world and in the physical world, they occupied the same space. They moved up against each other. They were these weird shapes, and they moved up against each other in exactly the way they should have. And I got lost, and for a moment, I forgot, for actually a long time, I forgot I was standing looking like an idiot, holding these things with this thing strapped to my face, like trying to drum on stars and make them make sounds like it. I just got lost. So imagine if you can also like lose yourself in your proprioception, in your vestibular senses, your taste maybe.
So what's the existential crisis?
The existential crisis is I'm a really bad sensor. Like, I cannot perceive reality effectively, right?
Well, none of us can.
I knew that. I knew that going in because I've worked in motion graphics. Like, I'm very aware of our cognitive biases. Like, these are things that I'm very interested in. And I really have no problem with the fact that I don't know what I'm doing, right? But this showed me
how bad it is.
To a larger, an even larger extent. I thought like, oh yeah, I know. We're all really crappy sensors. We're just idiots moving through the world. We feel like we're really productive when we multitask, but I know that's not true. We feel like we understand what's going on around us. We feel like we notice things. We all think we're good drivers. Like all of these things. I know I'm bad at all of these things. And then I went to SIGGRAPH and I discovered I'm so much worse than I already thought I was.
You're even more aware of how bad it is, yeah.
Yeah, and so I don't really know how to describe the existential crisis yet. It wasn't really an existential crisis.
Yeah, but I get what you're saying.
But it was a, like, I really am doubting myself. Like,
yeah.
We all
wouldn't
have
it be
this...
better if the world, if everyone understood that in the world?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Or would it be horrible for us to understand how bad we are at those kind of things?
I can say...
Is the illusion important?
It feels bad. Like, it feels bad. So if I'm pointing out, like, to someone who thinks they're really aware of what's going on, like, hey, by the way, you probably aren't, like, that probably feels bad. It doesn't feel bad to me because I'm already there, but...
I got a quick question for you. Forgive how personal it is, but have you ever suffered from depression?
Yeah.
Because one of the things I had read years ago was that if you suffer from depression, you are far more likely to see the world and your role within it accurately.
Mm. What?
Wait, is depression caused by that?
Well, that's it's or, just weird.
Like
I don't mean all about depression, because depression also can lie to you and tell you that you are completely worthless and whatever. But your skill level with something, what you'll find is that people with depression have a more accurate view of their skill level with different things, being pessimistic about it sometimes, than people who are considered normal, that they have rose-colored glasses about their ability and their aptitude.
Ben, when you're describing what the actual, quote, reality experience is of somebody putting on a headset. So when I got the first Oculus Rift, right, I got it early because I was part of the Kickstarter when I was at UCSC. And I just walked around and put it on everybody's faces. I don't know if I ever gave it to you because
you didn't.
You weren't around at the time or something. You'd moved away. But anyway,
no, I was around.
A lot of people, I put them on. And
I just,
of course,
wasn't special enough.
I think we didn't run into each other. But I put it on. I only had it for a few days until I went back to campus.
I think it was in a box. It was in a box, and you said, you should put that on.
Oh, okay.
And then I didn't do it because it was, you know, work.
A party or something like that. Anyway, I put it on these people. And, of course, the experience is, as you said, is that you all of a sudden are kind of transformed in this place. But in reality, you're blindfolded, right? Mm-hmm. And your hearing's impaired because there's headsets on you as well. And you're completely, you're being de-censored. Like, you are losing the qualities of being able to perceive the world.
You're being blindfolded. Your perception hijacked is the way I like to think of it.
Yeah, hijacked, yeah. But, of course, to the room full of people watching you, you're not engaged in the world anymore. You're completely removed, but you're still there. Like,
yeah.
It's a very interesting experience because, of course, I'd put it on people and then I'd chat with people around when, like, look, they're not seeing... They're blindfolded. They're standing there, and they're having an hallucination. Like it's another way of saying it is it's not a it's not a shared experience.
Hallucination feels judgmental, but I know what you mean. Like yeah.
Of course, we are all in that space anyway. Our perceptions of the space. Like right now, I think I know where the door in this room, but the truth is, it's behind me, so it could be on the right wall or the left wall. I don't really know. I guess
you have an intellectual way of figuring it out, not just your like one-time memory of entering. But yeah.
But you take my point that even though we think of that we're in a world that's shared reality that we have a perception of, as we investigate it more and more, we don't really. You know, you call this room a light purple. To my mind, it's really not a light purple. That's a simple example of it. But our perception is
a light regal purple.
Oh, a light regal. Oh, yeah. I didn't mention, what's a dark regal?
I think a or regal a purple regal. Is a dark purple.
Okay,
and so a light. Regal purple is like a
medium
light
purple.
Dark purple is, you know, anywhere in the medium. It's actually intentionally a little ambiguous. You know, strangely, it made me more open-minded. Like every time I learn about, I remember I went through a period where I was learning more and more about cognitive biases. And it was just through the perspective of skepticism, right? This is mm-hmm. kind of how I came to it. But the more I learned about cognitive biases, the less I trusted my own perception.
And rightly, we should.
Yeah. But that also made me more open-minded in a way. I mean, it made me a little more doubtful of other people who were really convinced of things because, you know, I saw the potential for cognitive biases in them. But yeah, it's been interesting seeing, like, ever since I got back, I've been a little more open to... ideas that I maybe wouldn't have previously been, or thoughts about about how I can't really perceive the world. Like, I don't know if this makes any sense, but
no, it does.
It just kind of like reframed all of my perception, which is kind of big.
Yeah. I've been reading Warren Sacks' soon-to-be-released book, Software Arts.
Yeah.
And it's a work he's been working on for years, and it's about software in general. It's a broad topic book, and I'm looking forward to when it's published. I can share it with everybody. And I'll probably have Warren on to talk a bit about the content and such. But one of the things he's discussing in one of the chapters I'm reading right now has to do with logic and rhetoric. And we think of logic in our current set as a very important thing. Maybe not completely everybody believes in truth, but in general, I think we all think of logic as really powerful and important. And rhetoric is like a skill that's kind of like manipulation or consult, you know, something else. And you can kind of look at them as they're both important for motivation, for sharing ideas, but we have a lot of judgment on one versus the other. And that shifts over time. One is more important than others sometimes. In any case, of course, right now what we're trying to do, we keep on saying that math and logic are closely tied together. In reality, that might be more fictitious than we think of it. When I talk about logic, I'm talking about traditional arguments of logic, the philosophical perspective of logic versus the way of rhetoric, of convincing. Anyway, so I felt very, you know, when you read good books that make you think, of course, you start shifting the way you think about the world, kind of like your experience with VR.
Yeah.
I think it's an important thing to do to yourself to kind of rethink your fundamental ideas.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
You want to follow that up with a story, Miles?
I was going to say happy birthday to the Debian Project. 25
Debian
years.
Debian Linux.
Yep.
25 years old?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And
what was special about the Debian build of Linux? Distro.
Debian is distinct from the Red Hat lineage, for example, in that while being package-based, it wasn't controlled by a single company. Highly democratized, and it is different from many of the predecessors besides the Red Hat and Debian lineages of having an actual package system, whereas ones like Slackware were very much you compile it on the fly. And
Debian's kind of like, I don't know, kind of matured to the level now where it's a very robust standard.
There are quite a few robust Linux ones, but they're Linux distributions, although they're kind of families, as they were, and Debian describes a family.
Yeah.
In much the same way that, like, from Debian has spawned things like Ubuntu and Raspbian, the default Raspberry Pi operating system.
Right.
Just as Red Hat spawned the Amazon Linux.
Red Hat's package is Yarn? No.
Yum.
Yum, yeah. And Debian's apt, or aptitude.
And then you have your ones like the one that you compile everything.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's safer that way, right? No packages, compile. Well, happy 25th birthday to Debian Linux. That's pretty cool.
And then one final little tidbit that I'm going to go very quickly with, which was with the news that Alex Jones and InfoWars is getting banned right and left on social media from Facebook pages.
Alex Jones, of course, is a
conspiracy theorist.
Yeah. Radio jockey conspiracy theorist who is really good at going from conspiracy theory to buy these vitamins or buy this supplement, whatever.
I don't know if he's really good. He just does it a lot.
It's impressive. I don't know. I find it impressive. And I think so go on. He recently was banned by
He got himself banned from Twitter for saying people should get their war guns ready to go, something along the, or battle guns. And just a lot of inflammatory stuff that generally breaks terms of services of any social media site.
And he's been breaking terms of services for a long time without being banned.
Right. And Apple, for iTunes, their podcast, they've actually cut him off. But they still have the app up, and they give rationales for it. So I just wanted to give a shout out to Apple that congratulations, Alex Jones and InfoWars as an app are acceptable, but naked breasts are not. And that difference between like how one is acceptable and the other. Although they are acceptable if you have Netflix. Then you can see all the nudity you want on an iPhone through an app.
Oh, interesting.
Or through a web browser. But an app that's dedicated to content that has nudity.
Like you're saying you couldn't like have a correct breastfeeding manual app on the App Store because it would have nude breasts.
Right.
But you can have a hate-incited
you can have
DJ dude.
An app backed by someone who regularly discusses parents of murdered children as being crisis actors,
right,
that get harassed. That app is okay.
Yeah.
But something like Playboy showing the images is not.
That's weird they didn't pull the app. I don't know why they didn't do that.
You can go up to our site and read Apple's rationale. It's been covered in a couple of different news organizations. I'm not going to do it here.
Okay.
I just thought I'd point out what I consider a bit of hypocrisy in that what we are willing to accept as a society and what we have this very draconian like unacceptability applied to it.
Well, thanks for the update on that. The pulling from the podcast directory was one of the first moves Apple pulled from the podcast directory. Actually, prior to that, it was pulled from other places as well, including from Overcast. Mocha Oman pulled it from Overcast, which is actually just a mirror of the Apple podcast directory. One of his listeners, users, had said to him, hey, why are you doing this? This guy's horrible. He pulled it because he looked at it. He's like, yeah, that doesn't fit the Apple's terms, sir. So he pulled it from his local copy. And then Apple, a few days later, also pulled it from their podcast directory. But, I don't know.
So if you deliver it by audio or video, they'll pull it. But if it's delivered dynamically through an app,
yeah,
it's okay.
The other thing that's interesting about that, of course, is it paid? Are they collecting revenue that way? Because for the podcast directory stuff, they don't make any money. But for the App Store, they do. Interesting. GeekSpeak is a registered source mark of David Lawrence. His user permission is GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. You can use our stuff any way you'd like. You can even make money off of it. Just let people know that we exist. The theme is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. And today's episode title by Greg Mercury in Canada is Martian Telescope Senses Wrecked Teslas. Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe, thank you so much for joining me this evening.
Always a pleasure. It's a wire mesh.
Oh, and there's be a top of wire mesh as well?
There will not be on anything on top.
Why?
There's no need.
Why do you need a side wire mesh? Oh, for your goaties.
Because we have goats.
It's the goat problem.
So there's, an area that will have a gate to get in, and then there's a secondary gate. That way is the kind of the airlock type of thing to keep the goats from munching everything.
That's cool.
The first morning we woke up in Hawaii, where I heard...
And
goats.
You're like, how did we get there?
Yeah, I heard goats. And we look over to the left and probably, 200 meters or so off on a bluff are these black billy goats. I guess they're billy goats. Maybe they're a collection of goats. Young goats, I think, but they're small. Anyway, they were fighting each other, kind of play fighting. And I'm like, what?
All goats of all sexes will do that, by the way.
Okay, so I have no idea if they're billy goats or not. Anyway, there's three black goats making goat sounds and banging their heads against each other in playful ways. I'm like, whoa. So a little bit later, I tell my daughter, yeah, there's wild goats. She was asleep at the time. And she's like, no, there's not. I'm like, yeah, there is. You could probably call to them. So she starts calling, making goat sounds. Can you make a goat sound, Ben? Meh. A little closer to the mic.
Meh.
It was kind of like that. It was more like a yell.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So she starts really doing good. That. And after about 15
practicing.
Minutes... They came back. And they responded to her. They're like, she's calling them back and forth. It's very cute.
At first, yeah. They were a little alienated by the accent, but...
That's right.
The key is sticking your tongue out while you do it, because that's...